Well, I quit last time because we were out of time, but I just wanted to show you that I was actually pretty much done with the chapter anyway. There's a slide left. I talked about slide 30 already, and slide 31 is really just a summary table. You see these in several of the chapters. I never read these to you because I've already told you about this stuff, but I include them as slides because they might be useful things to study with. I've already talked about all that, though. So let's go on to the next chapter, which is a tour of the cell. We are going to look at all of the various components of a cell, mostly eukaryotic cells. So most of those components are organelles, more membrane-bounded organelles in particular. The opening slide here, though, just shows you a scale of sizes of things that are important in biology. And this is a logarithmic scale. So each step is one order of magnitude bigger than the step below it. So there's 11 orders of magnitude spanning here, from the size of atoms all the way up to, well, not even as big as things get biologically. 10 meters is still not as big as some trees, tall as some trees. But that's 11 orders of magnitude is a huge range in size, right? That's 100 billion times as big. The top is 100 billion times as big as the bottom. But anyway, cells, which is the focus of this chapter, are in this yellowish range. There is some range in cell size, but as we'll talk about, I'll explain why in a little bit, there isn't a big range in cell size. Even though there are huge organisms, and compared to most organisms that are alive, we are among the huge organisms. Even for huge organisms, though, cells are not particularly big. Most cells, typical compact cells, are meaning not particularly big in one dimension, are small enough to be invisible. Most cells are invisible to the naked human eye. And that's why viewing them requires microscopy. A light microscope is enough to do the job. But you can see here that when things get too small for the unaided eye, there's a choice of microscope types. There's many choices, but there are light microscopes, which operate on humanly visible light, and electron microscopes, which bombard the image with electrons. And electron microscopes are really good at getting very fine detail. Light microscopes can't do that, but they're just fine for cells, which is what we're really looking at in this chapter. So let's start looking at cells in slide 2. This is not a eukaryotic cell. How can you tell that?
No nucleus.
Right, there is no nucleus, so it's a prokaryotic cell. And this one happens to be a bacterium, which, keep in mind, is one of the two domains that make up the prokaryotes, right? A prokaryotic cell is either in domain bacteria, which this one is, or in the domain archaea. They're very similar in a lot of respects, especially in their appearance to us, but molecularly they're different. In any case, though, all prokaryotic cells are a single chamber, since they don't have membrane-bounded organelles. They have just one membrane, namely the membrane that any cell, by definition of being a cell, has, which is the plasma membrane. That's the boundary between the cell and everything else. And that, since it only has that one membrane, that means everything that's inside that membrane is one compartment. So prokaryotic cells are not compartmentalized. We talked about this earlier on in the term. So that one compartment, everything that's in it collectively is called the cytoplasm. And there is no true nucleus, but of course, even prokaryotic cells have DNA for exactly the same reasons that we eukaryotes do. It's just not contained in its own compartment. It's not, though, randomly dispersed throughout the cytoplasm. The DNA is not. It's kind of condensed into one region that we call the nucleoid. Not a true nucleus, because it doesn't have its own membrane, but it's the region of the cytoplasm in a prokaryote where you find the DNA. There's a huge variety of shapes that prokaryotic cells can have. This is just one example, so not all prokaryotic cells will look like this. But in addition to a plasma membrane, a prokaryotic cell has exterior to that, typically a cell wall. And we'll see that plants also have these, and fungi do as well, but we animals don't have cell walls. Cell wall is much thicker and much stronger than the plasma membrane, which can be important for protecting the cell from exploding if pressures get too high. And we'll talk more about that later. But a cell wall is a separate structure from the plasma membrane. The cell wall is a bit like the structure of the wall of this room, what makes it strong, and the plasma membrane is like the paint on the interior of that wall, much flimsier, but just interior to it. There are no membrane-bounded organelles in prokaryotes, otherwise they wouldn't be prokaryotes, but there are these brown dots in the cartoon, which are ribosomes. Which ribosomes are organelles, but they are not membrane-bounded organelles. They're just little molecular machines, basically, and we'll talk about ribosomes in detail later, but prokaryotic cells have them for the same reason that we do, which is to build proteins. Ribosomes are the sites of construction of polypeptides, one amino acid at a time. That's done at the ribosomes. And you can see here that prokaryotic cells can have various kinds of cellular appendages. They might or might not. It just depends on the species. But this one is flagellated, meaning that it has flagella, which are whip-like tails. And it also has these hair-like fimbriae, which can aid in both locomotion, moving around, and in sticking to things. Slide 3. This has to do with any cell's plasma membrane. A plasma membrane is a complex mixture of things, but chiefly the plasma membrane is composed of the phospholipid bilayer, which self-assembles, as I said, simply because phospholipids are amphipathic, meaning that the head of the phospholipid, where the phosphate is polar because of that phosphate having a charge, and those parts don't mind being around water, whether inside or outside. And the tails, which are mostly, the fatty acid tails, which are mostly hydrocarbon, except for where they connect to the glycerol, those are hydrophobic because carbon and hydrogen equally share their electrons. And they don't want to be around water, which is polar. So they're avoiding water, the tails, by the phospholipids assembling this phospholipid bilayer. And that will happen just automatically without any life if you just put phospholipids into pure water. That's how the cells got started originally. But you have to have various other things in the plasma membrane to keep the cell alive, because certain things can't get into or out of the cell directly through this phospholipid bilayer. And if that's all you had, then you wouldn't be able to continue to have things brought in and get rid of things that need to be gotten rid of in order to stay alive. Therefore, you need, in addition to the phospholipids, which is basically the infrastructure of the plasma membrane, various other things. And chief among those probably are proteins of various sorts, which you see here in these bluish or purplish globs. And we'll talk more about membrane-bound proteins. These are membrane-bound proteins, right? Not membrane-bounded. They're not enclosed by a membrane. They are tied to the membrane. They are part of the membrane. Well, without the help of proteins, things wouldn't be able to get in to route. That's not the only function of membrane-bound proteins, but that's a major function. All right, four gets back to what I said just a little bit ago about the fact that there isn't really a huge range in size of cells. Even enormous organisms are made out of cells that are basically the same size as individual cells that make up unicellular organisms. You know, you started as a single cell. Everyone in here started as a single cell. The zygote that was created when sperm fertilized egg. That's one cell. That was microscopically small. Now you're much bigger, but you didn't just grow that one cell to become a human-sized single cell. And that's because that would have been impossible to stay alive as a huge cell. That's the major point of this slide. A cell cannot get big indefinitely in all three dimensions at the same time. It can't get tall, wide, and deep after it hits a certain limit. And that constraint or that limit that's put on cell size is what we call the surface area to volume ratio. Right, a ratio is just one number divided by another. It's a fraction, in other words. So surface area to volume ratio is the surface area of a cell divided by its volume, whatever number that is. Well, just to make the math easier to think about, we're using cubes here instead of spheres. Some cells are actually fairly cubical, but anyway, cubes are easier to deal with in thinking about the math here. So you have a single cell here represented by this first column, one cube. And notice there aren't any dimensions shown here, no units given, because the units don't matter to what the concept here is. It's one by one by one, whatever the units you choose. One cubic unit, though, right? Its volume is. But what is its surface area? Well, the surface area is the combination of all the areas of the faces. It has six faces, a cube, right? Each one is one by one, so one square unit, whatever the unit is. But there are six of them, so it has six square units of area. You see that? And it has one cubic unit of volume. One times one times one is one. Therefore, the surface area to volume ratio is 6 divided by 1, which is 6. All right. Now let's grow this cell. It's this size originally. Let's make it 5 times bigger in all three dimensions. That's this middle cell. So now it's 5 by 5 by 5. Well, look what happened. The surface area is now... Well, each face is now 5 by 5, so 25 square units, but there are 6 of them still, so it's 6 times 25, or 150 square units of surface area. And the volume is now 5 by 5 by 5, which is 125. Therefore, the surface area to volume ratio, 150 divided by 125, which is 1.2. Notice that as the cell grew, the surface area to volume ratio decreased. It went from 6 to 1.2, which is a drastic decrease. It's now almost only 1/6 of what it was before. And mathematically, this should make sense. You know, if you consider what's happening here, area is a square function and volume is a cubic function. So, like, if you graph just for the positive x's, y equals x squared, it's going to be like this, right? Y equals x cubed, which would be the volume, also curves upward, but it gets big a lot quicker than x squared does. And what this means, practically, for the cell, is that if you grow the cell in all three dimensions, boy, both the surface area and the volume are going to get bigger than they were, but the volume is going to grow faster than the surface area does for the same increase in overall size. And that's why it's a constraint. That's why cells can't get bigger than a certain limit, because in order to remain alive, the cell has to continuously exchange materials with the surroundings. That means in order to remain alive, things have to be able to come into the cell and leave the cell. Well, where is it that things come in and leave the cell? At the boundary between the cell and everything else, which is at the membrane, the plasma membrane, which the plasma membrane is what makes the surface area. So if you get bigger, your volume increases, of course. Even your surface area does too, but your volume gets so big that you have so many things in there that need to get in and out that you no longer have enough surface area to get it through. And therefore, cells don't grow infinitely big or indefinitely big. Instead, organisms get big not by having huge cells, but by having many cells that are small as run-of-the-mill cells. That's exactly what's happening here. This middle one represents a big unicellular organism, which would be prohibited because of the small surface area to volume ratio. But you could have the organism be just as big overall, but made out of a bunch of tiny cells. Notice this has the overall combined same volume. But by making it out of a bunch of one by one by one cells like this one, then when you do the math, you still have the same surface area to volume ratio, because small cells have more surface for the volume than large cells do. Now we can start talking about structures within the cell. This is slide 5. And it's a kind of a catch-all slide, meaning that not every cell is going to look like this, meaning it's not going to have necessarily every single thing that's on here. But they're all put onto this picture so we can talk about them at once. This, by the way, is an example. This is an animal cell that we're looking at here. And we'll see a similar slide with a plant cell in it. Not that animals and plants are the only organisms, but they're two major groups. Anyway, this is an animal cell, and it's going to take a while for me to get through this slide. You might have noticed that there's a lot of slides in this slideshow, but they don't take nearly as long as this one. So we'll still get through the slideshow. We'll be able to speed up once I get through these. This slide especially. Well, let's go through these parts kind of clockwise as they're listed, starting with the nucleus. Now, we've already talked about the nucleus a little bit. Of course, it's found only in eukaryotic cells, but I just told you this is an animal cell, and animals are eukaryotes, so you'd expect it to have a nucleus. The nucleus is, of course, a membrane-bounded organelle. But even more specifically, it is an example, one of three that I'll give you, of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. So not only is it membrane-bounded, enclosed by its own membrane, but there are two layers of membrane covering a nucleus, a cell nucleus. Now, by two layers, I'm not talking about the bilayer. The phospholipid bilayer that we just looked at, which is two layers of phospholipids, those combined make up one membrane. I'm talking about two membranes, so there's really two bilayers of phospholipids. You can kind of see it depending on how far away you are, but if you're looking at it on your computer, you can see on this cutaway view at the edge that there are two layers of membrane here. And those are very descriptively called the outer membrane and the inner membrane. But together, the two membranes make up what we call the nuclear envelope. And what is contained inside the nucleus, inside the nuclear envelope, is collectively called the nucleoplasm. It's not cytoplasm. I said this before in an earlier chapter, but let me say it again. The cytoplasm is the only thing, since this prokaryotes are not compartmentalized, everything inside a prokaryotic cell is collectively the cytoplasm. But that's not true for eukaryotic cells, because they are compartmentalized, since they have these extra membranes in the form of membrane-bounded organelles. So the nucleoplasm is all the stuff inside the nucleus. It's not part of the cytoplasm. The cytoplasm still exists in a eukaryotic cell, but it's all of the stuff that's in the cell itself, but outside of all the membrane-bounded organelles. All right? So all this purplish stuff is the cytoplasm, the nucleoplasm, sorry. And the most important part of the nucleoplasm is the DNA. That's where, in a eukaryotic cell, you find DNA, right? That's why DNA was called a nucleic acid, nucleic meaning inside the nucleus. Well, you see this word chromatin here. Chromatin is a mixture of materials. Chromatin is DNA and proteins that help stabilize the DNA. So the combination of the two, DNA and proteins, and specifically histone proteins, but we'll talk about that later, make up the mixture called chromatin. And that's in the nucleoplasm. This nucleolus word you should be careful with, because it looks so similar to nucleus. The nucleolus is part of the nucleus. And the job of the nucleolus is to produce RNA molecules other than messenger RNA. As we'll see later in detail, there's many kinds of RNA, including messenger RNA that I've already talked about, and that's involved in gene expression. But there's all kinds of other RNA types as well, and the nucleolus manufactures those RNAs. If you look closely at the nuclear envelope, you can see these violet-colored circular complexes. Those are complexes of proteins arranged in such a way as to make little holes here and there in the nuclear envelope. They form pores, in other words. That's important because things need to get into and out of the nucleus just like they need to get into and out of the cell itself. So these nuclear pores form a passageway for, one example, messenger RNA that gets created in transcription inside the nucleus, because that's where the DNA is. And remember, DNA's job is transcription. The messenger RNA is in the nucleus at the moment, if we're talking about a eukaryotic cell, which we are. Well, that mRNA has to get out of the nucleus and meet up with a ribosome in order for translation, the actual assembly of the polypeptide, to take place. And therefore, it has to get out of the nucleus, and it can do that through these nuclear pores. The outer membrane of the nuclear envelope, here and there, and you can see right here as an example, folds outward. It's, in other words, it's not just a smooth outer membrane just as big as the nucleus is. It covers the nucleus, but every once in a while, the outer membrane will form an outfolding, like right here. And you can see it's changing color here, not in real life, but in the cartoon scheme, it changes from the purplish nucleus color to this more blue color. It's all of this stuff. And it is the same membrane, but when it folds outward like this, it is becoming part of a different organelle. The second membrane-bounded organelle I'm mentioning here, which is all of this bluish stuff combined, and that is the endoplasmic reticulum. The endoplasmic reticulum is a membrane-bounded organelle, but as you see by the braces, or the brace underneath the word in all caps, the overall organelle, endoplasmic reticulum, or ER, is subdivided into two components, the rough endoplasmic reticulum and the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And all of this stuff is rough. What causes it to look rough in a microscope are all of these brown dots that you see studding its surface. Now that's all a complex membrane that's just folded back and forth. It looks like it's a bunch of little pockets, and there are pockets in it, but it's all one elaborate membrane. And the brown dots that are making its appearance look rough are ribosomes that I mentioned earlier. Ribosomes are not actually part of the rough ER. I mean, what I mean by that is ribosomes are their own organelles. Each one individually is a tiny organelle, not membrane bounded. And they are attached for the moment. Each one that you see here is temporarily attached to the surface, to the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, but it's not officially part of the ER. Okay, it's just an association right now between those two. But notice the smooth part, which not only is less of a pancake appearance and more of a tubular appearance, so it differs that way. Notice that it also is not rough in appearance because it doesn't have these ribosomes attached to it. It's still part of the ER, though. It's just a different part of the ER. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum's jobs, well, it has various jobs, but a major function of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum is production of lipids. The rough ER, on the other hand, has the major function of processing newly produced polypeptides. And this is exactly why you have all of these ribosomes attached to the surface of the rough ER. Because remember I said that the job of a ribosome, one of these brown dots, is to produce a brand new polypeptide under the instructions of messenger RNA. So the assembly of a polypeptide, one amino acid at a time, happens at each ribosome. And therefore, that's the assembly line for a polypeptide production. And if you have ribosomes temporarily attached to the surface of the rough ER, that brand new polypeptide coming straight off of the assembly line gets strung into the interior, or the lumen, which means the hollow interior of something, of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. So that's why they're there, because the job of the rough ER is to take those brand new polypeptides that have just been produced and modify them in some way so that they can do their final job. Not all proteins need to have modification after they're built, but many do. All right, let's go back this way now. Plasma membrane I've already talked about. Ribosomes I've talked about as well, but we'll look at all of these in greater detail when we get to different pictures. I just want to mention all these while they're all in one place. But physically speaking, as far as the material is concerned, the endoplasmic reticulum is continuous with the nuclear envelope. Right? It's all the same membrane. That outer membrane simply folds outward and becomes the beginning of the rough ER. That's why they changed the color. But they're considered to be distinct organelles. Well, you have, if it weren't for the coloring, you would probably confuse this teal-colored one for just more of the ER. This, though, is the Golgi apparatus, which is what this book calls it. It can also be called the Golgi complex, or sometimes just the Golgi, the dead Italian for which it's named. It is very similar in appearance. It's a system of flattened sacs made out of membrane. And when I say membrane, the membrane that makes the plasma membrane is really the same stuff that makes the membrane of any other membrane-bounded organelle. So membrane material is not only similar, basically the same stuff when you go from one organelle to another, but membrane material is continuously moving around, and we'll talk more about that as well. So it's not permanently part of any given organelle. It moves around. But this Golgi complex, even though it looks very similar to the rough endoplasmic reticulum, is a separate organelle with a completely different job. The rough ER's job, remember, is to modify newly made proteins. The Golgi apparatus, on the other hand, has the job of more or less serving as a receiving and shipping center. A shipping and receiving center takes things in and moves things out, right? Well, that's what the Golgi complex does. It receives, for the receiving part of that job, little packages, little sacs made out of membrane that we call vesicles, packages of newly modified proteins. Those are the ones that just came from the Golgi complex, because the Golgi complex, from the rough endoplasmic reticulum, because its job was to modify those proteins, right? After that modification is done, the rough endoplasmic reticulum packages that newly modified protein in a little sac made out of membrane called a vesicle and sends it to the nearby Golgi complex. Notice the Golgi is right next door to the endoplasmic reticulum. And so that's the receiving part of the job. It receives these vesicles of modified proteins. And then once they're in the lumen of the Golgi complex figures out where they need to go to do their final job. That's the shipping part of the receiving and shipping aspect of the organelle. So some proteins, for instance, need to be embedded into the plasma membrane to become membrane-bound proteins of the plasma membrane. And that's where they'll do their job. The Golgi figures that out and packages them appropriately. Others are fully exported out of the cell. Some proteins operate outside of cells, either as structures or whatever. But remember, no protein is built outside of a cell. It takes cellular machinery to build proteins. So they have to be built at ribosomes inside cells. But if their job is going to be as structural proteins, for instance, outside of the cell, they need to be exported. And the Golgi figures that out as well. Depending on where they're going, they're packaged differently. But they're packaged, once again, in little vesicles. Vesicles that are made out of the membrane that the organelle itself is made out of. Basically, just buds off a little piece of its membrane self to make these little sacs, these vesicles. And here's a vesicle right here showing you that's the same color. That used to be part of the overall Golgi apparatus. Now it's just a little piece of the Golgi apparatus's membrane that has been used to export its contents, which is protein. Lysosome is shown next, and there are several lysosomes in here, all the same color. They're also vesicles, small sac of membrane, but they have their own name, lysosomes, because they have a specialized function. Lice here is the same root as in hydrolysis. Lysis means splitting, remember. Lysa and zome means body. So lysosome means literally splitting body. That's because inside that vesicle that makes up the boundary of the lysosome, there are hydrolytic enzymes. Enzymes whose job it is to perform hydrolysis, which is the splitting of big things into small, right, as we already learned. Well, that happens inside of lysosomes. Now, why bother to have your own little organelle doing that? Why not just have that happening out in the cytosol? Because hydrolytic enzymes are dangerous things to have around. They can split into small things, even things you don't want to be split. So you want to have those potentially dangerous hydrolytic enzymes sequestered in their own little chamber, and you put in there what you want to get split, keeping the enzymes away from things that could be damaged. Next is this fairly large one of several. There's only two shown in this picture, but these bean-shaped ones are mitochondria, which is the plural of mitochondrion. A single one is a mitochondrion. And this is the second of three examples of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. The nucleus was the first one. It has two membranes. Most membrane-bounded organelles have one membrane. But the mitochondrion also has two. And you can kind of see it from there. There's an outer membrane, which is just a smooth covering, as big as it needs to be to cover the whole thing. And then there's an inner membrane, which is actually bigger than the outer membrane because it folds back and forth inside. We'll look at that closer in its own picture, in its own slide. But the major job of the mitochondrion is a complex set of reactions that we'll study in detail in Unit 3 called cellular respiration. Which is a way to maximize the amount of usable energy extracted from molecules that are originally in food. Of course, as I've said, we don't take food into our bodies, but we digest it into molecules that used to be part of the food. Those molecules, once they're in the cells, can be used as fuels, and you can get a hell of a lot more energy, usable energy, out of the fuels and stored in the form of ATP molecules if you undergo cellular respiration. That happens inside mitochondria. Peroxisomes are shown next, and outwardly they look just like any other vesicle, like a lysosome, for instance, but they get their own name because they, once again, have a specialized function. Peroxisomes are named for the fact that they have enzymes in them that allow for potentially harmful products of metabolism, including peroxides of various kinds, to be turned into safer stuff. Peroxides and other things are considered to be reactive oxygen species, or ROS. They can damage other materials, including the material that makes up the cell. So lysosomes deal with that by turning them into something else. This is also why antioxidants are so popular among the dietary crowd, because the reactive oxygen species are oxidants. Antioxidants keep those oxidants from damaging you. Now, microvilli are shown here. Microvilli is the plural of microvillus. Villus, with a U-S ending, is a word by itself. Villus means a finger-like projection. So there's villi in several parts in the body, for instance. Microvilli are simply small versions of that. They are not separate structures. Notice that they are just outward folds in the plasma membrane, forming these little finger-like projections. You know, if you imagine this whole thing as a balloon, if you had weakened spots in the balloon and kept blowing it up, it might poke out these little microvilli. They're still the same plasma membrane, though. All right, and you don't see this on every cell, but you do on this catch-all one. A good example of where you find them in your body would be the epithelium, or the inner lining of the small intestine, which is where most of the absorption takes place after the digestion puts it into small enough molecules to get into the body. That getting into the body is absorption. And that requires a lot of transport proteins. embedded in the membrane in order to get that absorption done. And therefore, the more membrane you have, the more proteins you can embed in it, and the more efficiently you can absorb the stuff while you have a chance, because it's passing through you, right? If you let it pass all the way through, that's waste. So microvilli greatly amplify the surface area. For instance, if you imagine this cutaway view where you see the edge of the plasma membrane as a shore, a beach around an island. On this smooth part, you know, if you imagine walking this distance from here to here, well, right here, that's a pretty straight walk, right? But if you try to go that same distance on here where the beach twists and turns, it's going to be a hell of a lot longer walk, right? Well, that's because you have a lot more surface area, well, when you two it into two dimensions, by undulating this membrane back and forth without actually affecting the volume. The volume of the cell doesn't really go up, but the surface area does by folding. And therefore, a lot more proteins can be embedded in there. Next is the cytoskeleton, which is all caps here, but notice the colon here. The cytoskeleton is a complex set of proteins, mostly, that come in three forms: microfilaments, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. All of them together make up what is called the cytoskeleton, because it's kind of analogous to our endoskeleton, the bones of our body, you know, forming a framework. Well, this is just an elaborate set of fibrous proteins, these three categories of fibrous proteins. And so they do have a support role. They keep things in place, for one thing, and they give shape and structure to the cell. But they also serve as little roadways. We'll get a better view of the microtubules later, but you see these yellow ones are microtubules. And they're running all through the cell, just like roads on a map. And just like real roads, you use those to transport things from one place to another, right? Trucks moving things around on roadways. Well, microtubules are little molecular roadways, and we'll see that there are specialized proteins called motor proteins that physically walk along those microtubules, carrying things along for the ride. You should never think of the cell, by the way, as an unchanging device. This is a static image, but a real cell is continuously changing. It's highly dynamic. But cytoskeleton, it has those three components, and we'll look at the individual kinds of fibrous proteins when we get a chance to see their own slide. Next is the centrosome. And this is a little bit confusing, and by the way, there are several words with very similar roots that can be confusing. But centrosome, it looks like it's pointing to this T-shaped thing. That's not the centrosome. The centrosome is this kind of yellowish halo, or just region that you see right here. The centrosome is a microtubule organizing center, meaning a place from which microtubules grow longer and longer. You can see that these microtubules are connected to the centrosome here. And at the moment, there's only one centrosome, but as we'll see later, there will eventually be two. This is an animal cell, as I've said, and they have the animal cell centrosome, which is the kind of hazy yellowishness, includes this T-shaped thing, which is two pieces. They look like two pieces of short licorice in this figure, forming a T. And those two pieces forming the T are called centrioles. So the centrioles are found in the centrosome, in an animal cell. Now, as we'll see in the next slide, plant cells also have centrosomes, but the plant centrosomes do not feature centrioles, which is one way you can tell by looking at this that it's an animal cell. The thing is, I can't really tell you much more about centrioles other than they are there because we haven't really figured out what they're good for. It stands to reason that they must do something, but we can't really figure it out. We don't know yet. But animal cells, animal centrosomes have centrioles, plant centrosomes do not. Flagellum is the only other thing we haven't talked about, and this is a good example of something that is on this catch-all picture but isn't necessarily on every animal cell. For instance, the vast majority of your own cells, which are animal cells, of course, are not flagellated cells. But what's a good example of a human cell that has a flagellum? Sperm cells have these whip-like flagellum appendages that propel them from point A to point B to try to get to an egg. All right, that's that slide. Six is very similar, as you can see. But this is a plant cell. It doesn't take as long to get through this slide because plant cells have most of the things that animal cells have, and I therefore don't have to talk about them again. But there are some things that plant cells have that animal cells do not have. For instance, as I've already mentioned, a plant cell has a cell wall. It has a plasma membrane. Every cell has a plasma membrane. That's really what defines the cell. But in an animal cell, it's just the plasma membrane. That's the only covering. In a plant cell, you have that plasma membrane, which is this lightish brown-orange, and then a much thicker, sturdier cell wall in dark brown outside of that, or exterior to the plasma membrane. That's why I was saying earlier that the actual structural walls of the room are like the cell wall, and the paint on the interior of the walls is like the plasma membrane. Now, that, as I said earlier, is really important in maintaining pressure, internal pressure in the cell, without exploding. And I'll tell you in lab, actually, why that's so important to plants. They need to be able to withstand pressure, otherwise they would burst. But that's cell wall. And cell wall material, of course, is created inside the cell because it's mostly proteins, but then exported to form these boundaries between the individual plant cells. Next thing that plant cells have but animal cells don't are these green organelles. And this is the third of three examples of multiply membrane-bounded organelles. These green ones are chloroplasts. And the reason that no animal cell has chloroplasts are because the major function of the chloroplast is photosynthesis, a complex set of reactions that allows for organic compounds, sugars specifically, to be produced out of inorganic starting materials. That is what producers do. I think I told you earlier that ecologically speaking, there are two groups of organisms in the world based on how they live. There are the producers and the consumers. The producers are the only things that can produce their own food. They feed the whole world, not just themselves. By producing food, what I mean is producing organic compounds. These carbon-containing compounds that we've been talking about. Producers of the world do that, make these organic compounds, starting with inorganic material. CO2 in a plant, for instance, is inorganic, remember, even though it contains carbon, CO2 is inorganic. And by the very many chemical reactions that make up photosynthesis. CO2 gets used as starting material for organic material. Only producers can do that. All of the consumers have to get their nutrients already in organic form. They can't take inorganic material and make it into organic. So that's why all of the consumers of the world absolutely rely on the producers to do that. Well, plants are not the only producers, but they're the conspicuous ones that we see all the time, since we're land dwellers. And the photosynthesis that makes them producers occurs in chloroplasts. Multiply membrane bounded, you can see multiple membranes right here. We'll look at those in detail as well, just like the mitochondria, and we're going to study cellular respiration and photosynthesis in detail, so we'll be taking a look at those again. You have a bunch of stuff that I've already talked about for animals that occurs just in plants as well. Another one that doesn't occur in animals, though, is this huge one called the central vacuole. And it looks empty here. It's not actually empty. It's filled with at least water and usually other stuff as well. But it can take up quite a big chunk of the volume of the overall cell, enclosed by its own membrane, and the plant can use it kind of like a waste dump. In other words, it can put stuff into the central vacuole that it wants to keep away from everything else in the cytoplasm, but it also can be a storage place for pigments, you know, like in the lab, I think we look at red onion cells, and what makes red onion look red is not the whole cell, the redness, the pigment molecules are in the central vacuole. But the central vacuole is also why some plants can grow so much faster than animals. Right? You can overnight see quite a big change in the size of a seedling. That would be a lot of growth if that were in an animal, right? It'd be a shocking amount of growth overnight. But part of the reason is that both of those organisms, a plant and an animal, grow by adding more and more cells. As I just told you, it's not that cells get big, it's that more and more cells are added. And for a plant, each cell is not as expensive to make because it can be mostly water in the form of this central vacuole. And water doesn't have to be produced, right? Water just needs to be imbibed or taken in. And as long as it's available, then the plant can grow a lot faster. Is there anything else that... Oh, yes, the plasmodesmata. This is a plural word. The singular is plasmodesma, without the T-A. And each plasmodesma is a little tunnel. It's an example of what is called an intercellular junction. Simply a junction between two cells, what intercellular means. And it is operating as a tunnel, meaning it's a passageway for things that are able to get through there. But notice that it goes through the thickness of the cell wall that's between two cells. Here you have the interior of one cell. It's not shown, but you can imagine the interior of the next cell right here. This cell that you see has its own plasma membrane, right? But notice that the inner lining of the tunnel, the plasmodesma, is continuous with the plasma membrane. So plasma membrane material lines the tunnel as well and then becomes continuous with the plasma membrane of the next cell. It's really all one compartment. Even in a huge plant, like a tree, made of quadrillions of cells, because of these plasmodesmata, this chamber inside this cell is really continuous with all the other cells' chambers. But not just anything can pass through those plasmodesmata. They have to be small enough, first of all, and have to be chemically the right stuff to get through there. But they're passageways, which means they are a way for cell-to-cell communication. Animals have a very similar thing, but we'll look at those later, and they're called something different. Okay, that, I think, is everything. I've mentioned everything. Let's now go a little quicker through these slides as we look at individual ones I've already talked about closer up. So in slide 7, we get a better view of the nucleus and the rough endoplasmic reticulum. It makes sense to show these together because of what I've already told you. They are connected because the membrane that forms the endoplasmic reticulum is really just an outfolding of the membrane that forms the outer layer of the nuclear envelope. But looking at them in closer view, you can get a better view of these nuclear pores. Each pore is a set of proteins arranged with a hollow interior, so they're little tunnels as well. And you have the whole nuclear envelope studded with these pores so things can get in and out. The rough ER, you still don't really get a good view of ribosomes, individual ribosomes, because they're so tiny. But you can see them studying the surface of the rough ER. That's why it was originally called the rough ER. Now, slide 8 does show you, at least in cartoon version, a much better view of a single ribosome. Although this diagram of a ribosome that you see here is actually a lie, and that's because even though it's true that an individual ribosome is made of two subunits called the large and small subunit, or large and small ribosomal subunit. Even though that's true, the large and small subunits are not together, as you see here, unless the ribosome is currently being used and has messenger RNA between those two subunits. So these are modular structures, ribosomes, meaning that all large subunits are the same and all small subunits are the same. And this small subunit is at the moment part of this ribosome, but the next moment it might be matched up with some other large subunit. That's what I mean by modular. But they don't come together until it's time to actually build a protein. And that requires messenger RNA, not shown here, and that's why it's a lie, to be in between the two, and then they clamp together. We'll look at the details of that later, but that is the job of a ribosome, translation. The translation part of the two-step process of gene expression, right? When you express a gene, your intent is to build a protein, but that involves first using the DNA in transcription to rewrite those instructions in the form of an RNA molecule, and then the RNA molecule matches up with a ribosome to actually do the job of translation, which builds that polypeptide or protein. Another thing that we see in this slide, though, that I haven't mentioned yet, is that ribosomes come in two varieties, or at least they're named in two varieties. They're really the same ribosomes. But we use the phrase free ribosome and the phrase bound ribosome. A free ribosome is no different from a bound ribosome, other than the fact that a free ribosome at the moment is not connected to anything. Bound means it's the past tense of bind, right? A bound ribosome is connected to something. And specifically, a bound ribosome is connected to the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum. That's what gives the endoplasmic reticulum its roughness, right? Those bound ribosomes. But we'll look at the details later. The thing is, this is just a word game. It's not different organelles. All complete ribosomes, meaning ones that are being used to build a protein, start out as free ribosomes, unattached. And then some of those become attached to the membrane of the ER, and then they're it's the same thing, but its name gets changed to bound ribosome. Nine. no real new information as far as the structures are concerned here, but you get a good view here of a vesicle being budded off of the membrane that's part of the ER at first, but as soon as it pinches off and becomes its own little bag of membrane material, then it's a vesicle, it's no longer part of the ER. And this is part of that continuous moving around of membrane material that I was talking about. A little later, this membrane that makes up this little vesicle, which was part of the ER, might be part of the plasma membrane. And it just, and then the next moment, it could be taken back up into the cell as a vesicle and become part of the ER again. It's continuously being moved around and recycled. Okay, that brings us to 10. Closer view of the Golgi complex. And the red arrow is nice here because it shows you the directionality of how this works. Now keep in mind where this is situated in the cell. This is an isolated Golgi complex, but remember that in the overall view on this this side, not the arrowhead, but the tail of the arrow, is where you would have the rough ER, right? The Golgi complex is right up against the ER. But there's directionality to the Golgi. In other words, it's polarized. It has two different ends because of its dual functions. It is a receiver and a shipper. Well, the tail of the arrow shows you the receiving end. And just like in when we studied the isomers, geometric isomers specifically, remember there was trans and cis use of those words. Well, we have a cis face, which is the receiving end of the Golgi complex, and it receives packages of proteins that are in little vesicles made out of material that used to be membrane of the ER, and that's what these vesicles are, and that's why this one is blue. It's the same color as they used for the gold for the ER, but it's on its way to the receiving end or the cis face of the Golgi complex. Membrane material is made out of phospholipids mostly, as we've talked about. And therefore, when a vesicle encounters a bigger membrane, like this one is about to and does right here, that membrane material will just basically kind of melt into the other membrane, as you're seeing right here. And notice these little purple spheres inside represent the recently modified proteins, because that's the job of the rough ER, right? It has already received those proteins directly from the ribosomes that manufactured them, right? The ribosomes that are the roughness of the ER put those proteins into the ER. The ER modified them somehow, and then it packaged them into vesicles. Now the vesicle melds into or fuses with the membrane of the Golgi complex, and it becomes part of its membrane. But that spills the contents into the lumen, the hollow interior of the Golgi complex. And that's when the Golgi complex, having received that package, figures out where that needs to go. And so it travels from cis face to the trans face. The trans face is facing the plasma membrane, not facing the ER. And the trans face is the shipping end of the whole arrangement. So to ship it, it needs to be put into a new vesicle, not the vesicle it came in, but a new vesicle that's made by an outpocketing of membrane that makes up the Golgi. So this is how membrane stuff moves around continuously. And then that membrane is going to go somewhere else, typically to the plasma membrane, where it will become part of the plasma membrane and either spill that contents out or make it part of the plasma membrane itself. Here we have a couple processes being illustrated. Phagocytosis on the left is one type of what we call vesicular transport. And we'll be talking more about this later as well. But vesicular transport, vesicular is just the adjective of vesicle, meaning transport involving a vesicle. But vesicular transport is one of three major transport processes that can move things into or out of cells. It's the only one of the three, though, that uses vesicles to do it, and that's why it's called vesicular transport. Well, vesicular transport is a general term and doesn't tell you which direction it's going, right? Could be going into or out of the cell. If it's using a vesicle, if it's vesicular transport moving into the cell, then we call it endocytosis. Endo means in, cyte means cell, osis means condition. If it's the same thing but in reverse, so you're exporting something out of the cell using a vesicle, then it's exocytosis. So those two together, endocytosis and exocytosis, make up vesicular transport. Endocytosis is always inward, but we distinguish two types of endocytosis, two major types, one of which is phagocytosis, shown here. The other form of endocytosis, other major form, is pinocytosis. Now, the phage or phag part of that phagocytosis means eat. Same root as in esophagus, the eating tube. Pino means drink. So phagocytosis literally means cell eating, and pinocytosis means cell drinking. It's really the same process. A vesicle is used to bring something into the cell, but we distinguish the two based on what it is that's being taken into the cell. If it's solid chunks, like you see here, that's more like eating. So we call that phagocytosis. Pinocytosis isn't shown on this slide, but it would be the same thing. The plasma membrane folds inward to make a little pocket, but if it just takes a little sip of the liquid exterior instead of a solid chunk, then we would call it pinocytosis. All right, this is how cells can get things into themselves. And in this case, this is some food particle. Food for the cell, not food, macroscopic food that you eat. But anyway, it's food. Calling it food means that it's going to be digested for energy. And doing that involves enzymes that it needs to be exposed to. Like I said before, those enzymes are dangerous things to have around, right? So this lysosome contains the enzyme safely. It's covered with membrane. Well, so is this food vacuole, because it was part formerly of the plasma membrane itself. They're same material, so they can fuse together, and now you have the food particle mixed with the enzyme safely away from the rest of the cell, where it can be digested. A very similar thing is happening on the right here, but notice this is called autophagy. Same PHAG root, meaning eat, but this means self-eating. So instead of importing something for digesting, cellular digesting, not digestive system digesting, this thing is breaking down a piece of itself. So this example is using a mitochondrion. It's a mitochondrion that has seen better days. It's done a good job, but it's worn out. So it's not just scrapped, because it's made of material that's valuable. It's just not going to function as a mitochondrion anymore. So you package it together with a lysosome containing enzymes, and it can break it apart and reuse those materials to build something new. 12. Well, this is a plant cell. If you haven't already noticed that, this is a better view of the central vacuole. It still looks empty, but it's not actually empty. It's really just mostly water. But in the actual photograph here on the bottom, this is scanning micrograph, you can see just how much of the volume of the cell the central vacuole can take up, which is what I was saying about plant cells growing quickly. Now to 13. Here we have no real new structural information, but a better view of this whole process of vesicles budding off of one organelle and becoming part of another organelle, and then membrane is being moved around all the time. the real new view you see here is what I've said in words already. The vesicles that bud off of the transface of the Golgi, which is the shipping center, will then become continuous with the plasma membrane. That will unfold now that it's fused with the plasma membrane. And so this cyan membrane will be part of the plasma membrane. And the contents, in this case, just get spilled all the way out. This is an example of exocytosis, because this is using a vesicle to move something out of the cell. It's just the opposite of endocytosis. And by the way, I don't remember whether I have a picture, but you can imagine it. If this... Well, I think I do have a picture, so I'll just leave it. 14. Close-up of the mitochondrion. And what did I say its job is? Correct. Cellular respiration. And not all cells, not all eukaryotic cells have mitochondria. Remember that first animal cell thing was a catch-all. Many do, but a eukaryotic cell that does not have a mitochondrion is not capable of cellular respiration. Doesn't mean it can't get any energy from materials that came from food. It just can't get nearly as much. This includes our red blood cells, by the way. Our red blood cells don't have mitochondria. They don't even have nuclei. That's kind of a good thing, though, because cellular respiration uses up oxygen, and the job of red blood cells is to carry oxygen to the rest of the body. So if they had mitochondria, they would be using a bunch of that oxygen that they're trying to deliver. Anyway, you can see in plain detail now, with this close-up, that the mitochondrion is multiply membrane-bounded, just like the nucleus is. It has an outer membrane, which, as I said, is just a smooth membrane, just big enough to cover the whole thing. And the inner membrane is actually, in terms of surface area, much bigger than the outer membrane, but it can fit in the outer membrane because it has a lot of folds in it. And so these folds accomplish what? Right, they drastically increase the surface area exactly the way that microvilli do for a plasma membrane. And for exactly the same reason. The more membranes you have, the more proteins you can embed in it. In the case of the mitochondria, those proteins embedded in this inner mitochondrial membrane are the ones that are important for cellular respiration. We'll look at those later when we get to the details. Each major fold, by the way, of the inner membrane is called a crista, singular, or Christi for plural. So there's several Christi in the one inner membrane. And since, well, first of all, any membrane-bounded organelle is its own compartment compared to the cytoplasm, right? Because of that membrane. But the mitochondrion has two membranes, and therefore the mitochondrion itself has sub-chambers. It has two compartments inside it. One compartment is the compartment that's between the two membranes, between the outer membrane and the inner membrane, this region right here, which is called the intermembrane space, self-descriptively. And that's a different compartment spatially, but also chemically it's different stuff occupying that compared to the compartment that's fully inside the inner membrane in here. That's called the mitochondrial matrix. So the matrix is the inner compartment, the intermembrane space is the outer compartment, but they're both inside the overall mitochondria. An interesting thing about mitochondria is that they have their own ribosomes, as you see here. And these ribosomes have exactly the same job as the ribosomes out in the main cytoplasm, the ones that get bound to the rough ER. And that job, of course, as I've said, is to manufacture, to build polypeptides. But mitochondria have their own because mitochondria evolved from separate organisms in what is called the endosymbiotic theory. We talked about an example of endosymbiosis before, right? The cow having bacteria in one of its stomachs to digest cellulose. That's endosymbiosis. But the endosymbiotic theory explains how chloroplasts and mitochondria came onto the scene in early eukaryotic history. There were eukaryotic cells going around engulfing things. That's how they would get their nutrition, engulfing other cells, typically bacteria, which are smaller. They're just eating them, basically. Somewhere along the line, this happened, and instead of the bacterium that got engulfed being killed, it survived the process and took up residence inside the cell and kept living. And not only was it a bacterium, but specifically a bacterium capable of cellular respiration, which there are still examples of. And this explains why a mitochondrion has two membranes. Because the eukaryotic cell engulfed the bacterium that has its own membrane originally, right? When you engulf it, you're covering it with your own membrane, like we saw in those pictures of phagocytosis. So that outer membrane represents the original engulfing membrane of the eukaryotic cell, and this inner membrane is the membrane of the bacterium. And since it's a bacterium that was capable of cellular respiration, and since it survived, that's what it continued doing inside the eukaryotic cell. That's where cellular respiration in eukaryotic cells happens, in mitochondria, which are, they're really bacteria originally that got engulfed. And now it's not just kind of makes sense. There's a lot of evidence for this beyond just that it makes sense. One of which is that the ribosomes that mitochondria have are like bacterial mitochondria, are like bacterial ribosomes that we still see in individual free living bacteria. They're chemically different from the subunits that make up the ribosomes in the major compartment of the cell. And even more compelling evidence is that mitochondria also have their own DNA. And the DNA is just like bacterial DNA, as we'll look at later. It has circular chromosome instead of our linear chromosomes. And even more evidence is that mitochondria, just like free-living bacteria, can reproduce themselves by splitting into two. So that's how you get more mitochondria within a cell. They actually reproduce like free-living cells. And so that's pretty compelling evidence that the endosymbiotic theory is actually how this happened. But the particulars of the process of cellular respiration will leave to a different unit. You'll be tested before you actually get into the details of that. By the way, slide 15, and I have to end here, but I'll just say that the same exact theory, endosymbiotic theory, explains chloroplasts as well. Everything I just said about mitochondria is true of chloroplasts as well. They came from bacteria that got engulfed, but these were photosynthetic bacteria, which still exist. They were the original photosynthesizers of the world. And they have their own DNA, they have their own mitochondria. They reproduce by splitting just like free-living bacteria do. But that's where I'll end, and I'll see you in a couple days.